One of the things I wonder about, as observing the Cary Grant situation, I wonder if perhaps he may have been having the affair with Vicky Morgan, if in fact that was the case, as part of work for British intelligence. I wonder whether Cary Grant, as is very, very often the case, continued to work on and off for British intelligence. Intelligence services often requisition the services of former agents, quote-unquote, when they want to maintain a high degree of plausible deniability. They want to be able to deny any contact if the person is discovered doing whatever it is they're doing. I wonder if perhaps Cary Grant's liaison with Vicky Morgan may have been part of his ongoing work for British intelligence, and I wonder if perhaps he was keeping an eye on Reagan. Again, that is speculation and should be classified as such, but it's something interesting to contemplate here, given the fact that Grant was working for British intelligence, monitoring reactionaries in and around Errol Flynn. And as we're going to see as we listen to a tape segment, there are a lot of unanswered questions about just how deeply Ronald Reagan's background with intelligence goes, and how far back in time some of his Nazi connections go. And again, if this sounds a little wild or kooky, just bear in mind some of the political background and historical background already touched on. The fondness of many powerful industrialists and financiers in the United States and Europe for fascism, the history in which many key Third Reich alumni and some of the most vicious were put to work either for our intelligence services and or defense industry after the war. The Galen Organization and the Paperclip people being front and center. The participation of explicit fascist elements in the federal government, and specifically in this country's political assassinations in the 1960s and early 70s, signifying the ominous portent of some of these associations. So, again, we're going to take a look now at the background of Errol Flynn as a Third Reich intelligence agent, his association in Warner Brothers in a couple of movies with Ronald Reagan. We're going to take a look at what they were both doing. And again, who knows just how long Cary Grant had been keeping an eye on Ronald Reagan. If British intelligence felt that Reagan was a possibility to succeed to the White House in the early 70s, as he eventually did, they would naturally have been investigating his situation. And if he was believed to have Nazi sympathies, and there are some indications that he may have, his post-war record when he was very close to organizations like the John Birch Society, explicitly reactionary, basically fascist in nature, British intelligence would have wanted to know about Ronald Reagan. I wonder if perhaps Cary Grant's attachment to Vicky Morgan was more than just passionate in nature, whether perhaps he was operating in a professional capacity still on behalf of British intelligence. Again, that is pure rumination, but it is something to think about in this context. We're now going to take a look at a section of One Step Beyond from from September 8th of 1985. Again, this particular segment here is from One Step Beyond from September 8th of 1985. We're going to listen for about the next half hour or so, and there'll be a brief interruption when I turn the tape over, to discussion between myself and my former co-host Nip Tuck. First of all, Ronald Reagan's role as an FBI informant, beginning when he was informing for the FBI on someone with Nazi sympathies in Hollywood in the mid-1940s. Then we're going to take a look at Errol Flynn's background as a Nazi spy. Again, I will be accompanied on this tape by my former co-host Nip Tuck, who does his characteristically excellent job on the tape. Those of you who are taping may have a little bit of problem, though, because there are very unequal levels. Nip Tuck is potted up much, much higher in this particular tape than I am, so you may have to correct for that as you listen to the tape. So of Ronald Reagan and the FBI, Ronald Reagan and Errol Flynn, and Errol Flynn and the Third Reich, here we go from September 8th of 1985, One Step Beyond.
Interesting information about President Reagan came to light in the San Jose Mercury of Sunday morning, August 25th of 1985. It's an article by Scott Herhold, H-E-R-H-O-L-D, entitled Reagan Acted as Informant for the FBI. As a budding politician in Hollywood's acting community after World War II, Ronald Reagan served as a confidential informant for the FBI, according to records released by the Bureau. The FBI documents obtained by the Mercury News in a Freedom of Information request show that Reagan, identified as T-10, unquote, kept agents informed about pro-communist influences in the Screen Actors Guild and other Hollywood organizations. The reports show that he and his first wife, actress Jane Wyman, provided the FBI with the names of actors whom they believed were members of a clique with a pro-communist line. The first record of an FBI agent interviewing Reagan came on November 18, 1943, in connection with an FBI investigation of an unnamed German sympathizer. Reagan, then 32, was assigned to the Army Air Corps' motion picture unit at Camp Roach in Culver City. According to the FBI report, Reagan told of nearly coming to blows, unquote, with a German sympathizer at a cocktail party because the latter made several anti-Semitic remarks. Due to the nature of the remarks made by subject, Reagan became highly incensed and withdrew from the conversation, the FBI report said, quote, although he emphasized that considerable drinking had been done by all persons involved, unquote. Now, one of the things that's interesting about Ronald Reagan having served as an FBI informant is the fact that Ronald Reagan, in an earlier release, earlier in the spring, that we'll go over in weeks to come with you, a partial release of Reagan's FBI files, it revealed that Reagan was considered at one point during the 40s to be a subversive, quote-unquote. That raises the question of how an informant could be considered a subversive. It's not a question, obviously, that we have a definitive answer to, but we're going to examine one line of thinking this evening and present some information, hopefully by way of preventing what we're afraid might happen if this information turns out to be correct. But we're going to be taking a look at the career of another actor who was also very politically inclined and who we know for a fact was a subversive, quote-unquote. Now, on World Watchers International, Mae Russell has been discussing for some time her belief that Ronald Reagan may very well have been an operative of a Nazi spy ring operating in Hollywood and all over the West Coast, run by none other than Errol Flynn, the Adventures of Robin Hood star Don Juan, Captain Blood, and so forth. Errol Flynn, lived up to his reputation as a Don Juan. However, his reputation as a hero and a patriot turned out to be the exact opposite of the truth. Now, in fact, Ronald Reagan was a very, very important Nazi intelligence agent during World War II. Nip's going to read you a section from Charles Higham's book about Errol Flynn. Some of the episodes in Flynn's spying career for the Nazis that are not covered by the section that Nip is going to read. First of all, his control was a guy named Dr. Hermann Urban, E-R-B-E-N, a very important fellow who touches all kinds of bases. We looked at him in connection with arms smuggling to South Africa some months ago. He did all kinds of things before, during, and after the war. At one point, he ran a group of Gestapo agents that worked with the Shah of Iran. Flynn worked under the supervision of Urban, and he was involved in a number of different things, a German-sponsored IRA plan to assassinate the King and Queen of England when they came to this country. Flynn was very close to Sean Russell, who was the head of the IRA and an Abwehr agent for Germany, and the IRA and Germany sharing a hatred of and war against England. Flynn was also apparently very much involved with the funneling of information to a Nazi spy ring run out of Shanghai by a guy named Siefkin, who we're going to talk about, S-I-E-F-K-E-N. This information concerned the U.S. facilities at Pearl Harbor. It was given to the Japanese, and we know what happened next. Flynn was involved also in infiltrating. These are just some of the escapades that Flynn was involved with. He was involved with infiltrating the Loyalist cause in Spain while working under the cover of a Hearst journalist, and he infiltrated the International Brigade, or attempted to, and his friend, Dr. Urban, gave information to the Nazis about the German members of the International Brigade. These are just some of the episodes of Flynn's spying career that he was involved in. We've spoken many times in the past about the books Trading with the Enemy and American Swastika by Charles Higham. Higham was originally a Hollywood writer, and he came on the whole subject of Nazis when he went to do a biography of Errol Flynn, who was one of his boyhood idols, by the way. And Higham mentions that as a boy in London, he actually was called upon to fight some of the fires on the roofs of London during the Blitz, and that Errol Flynn was one of his heroes, and that he was discouraged and very shocked to learn that his hero was in fact a Nazi spy during World War II. And Higham then published those results as well as other biographical information about Flynn in a book called Errol Flynn, The Untold Story. The book was copyrighted in 1980 and 1981 by Higham, published in hardcover by Doubleday, and in soft cover by Dell. And Nip's going to read you some more about Errol Flynn.
Okay, and Haim writes in, Errol Flynn, The Untold Story, shortly before shooting The Adventures of Robin Hood, Flynn secretly flew to England. Quote, all the alarm signals went off, the Ministry of Defense spokesman said. This, of course, is the British Ministry of Defense.
What the section here that Haim is going over concerns his direct review of the British intelligence files on Charles Haim from World War II.
Right. Shortly before shooting Robin Hood, Flynn secretly flew to England. Quote, all the alarm signals went off, the Ministry of Defense spokesman said. We put a special watch order out on Flynn, unquote. The designation of the Flynn file was changed from sympathetic neutral to espionage agent. MI5, of course, British intelligence, MI5 spies followed Flynn via Cherbourg to Paris. They found that he was at a secret meeting very late at night with the Duke and Duchess of Windsor at the Hotel Meurice. The introduction was arranged by Flynn's friend Charles Bedeau, B-E-D-A-U-X, American industrialist and Nazi collaborator. MI5 followed Flynn on the train from Paris to Obersalzburg, where the trail ran out just short of the security area at Berchtesgaden. It was presumed that he had gone to see Hitler. This is about 1937, by the way. He was traced to Berlin, where he met with Rudolf Hess and Martin Bormann. He flew with these men to Paris to meet the Windsors. MI5 bugged the meetings. They showed that Flynn was helping connections between Hess, Bormann, and pro-Nazi British aristocrats. They also revealed that Himmler, Hess, Bormann, and certain British aristocrats were, like Flynn, subscribers to Frank Buchmann's former famous moral rearmament movement. Buchmann was a keen supporter of Hitler. The file of the Ministry of Defense started there. Flynn, as we know, returned to America in 1937 and stayed there until after World War II. During World War II, an agent of MI6, British Intelligence Abroad, was parachuted into Germany to crack the Abwehr safes and specifically to recover Flynn's file. He brought back word that Flynn and Professor Flynn had substantial files showing that Errol was an agent of the Abwehr, as well as of the SD, or Gestapo.
Professor Flynn, by the way, was his father, who was also pro-Nazi, as that passage indicated, and appears to have had something to do with introducing Flynn to some of the higher Nazi circles. Now, it's worth noting that Errol Flynn's Nazi activities continued after World War II, where he appears to have functioned as an agent of some of the Nazi escape networks, such as Odessa, Kameradenwerk, Die Spinne, and so forth, all of which we've talked about in the past. The distinctions between those various networks vary depending on which author you read, but there are a number of Nazi and specifically SS fraternal and support organizations and financial, they also function financially and ideologically as well. Flynn appears to have been connected with these. Returning again to Errol Flynn, The Untold Story. The news of, speaking here, Haim is speaking about information which came to light since his hardbound edition had been published. The news about Errol Flynn, The Untold Story, first broke in January of 1980. Rona Barrett revealed the story on television after calling the State Department to verify my findings. A short time later, Jane Chesis, C-H-E-S-I-S, Flynn's secretary in Rome in the early 1950s, came to my house. She told me that Flynn had a cabinet in his Rome apartment which he always kept locked, even from her. One day in 1952, a letter for Flynn arrived from Argentina. She opened it, as was her custom. It was signed Hermann Schwinn, S-C-H-W-I-N-N, and asked for help for himself and for a Gerhard Wilhelm Kunze, K-U-N-Z-E. Or perhaps Kunze, I don't know. She would have thought nothing of the letter if she had not noticed that the locked cabinet was open. She could not resist looking in. There in the file-marked letters, she saw correspondence from Schwinn and other Germans. She took the file out. She heard a sound. Before she could turn, a hand grasped her shoulder and swung her around. She found herself looking at Errol's face. It was distorted with rage. He pulled the file from her and it fell to the floor, spilling documents with swastikas and eagles stamped on them. She noticed that some of the dates were from World War II. Flynn threw her down on the floor. She managed to get to her feet and ran out of the room. She quit her job that day, but Flynn begged her to return. When, out of curiosity, she did so after a week, the cabinet was missing. Some months later, She asked Flynn the identity of a man whose photograph was in his bedroom. Drunk at the time, he told her that the man was Hermann Schwinn. Who, Jane Chessis asked me now, were Schwinn and Kunz. I was able to tell her that Schwinn was the West Coast leader and Kunz the overall leader of the German-American Bund, the Nazi Party organization in the United States. Schwinn was also chief of the SD, the foreign branch of the Gestapo Secret Service in California. Both Schwinn and Kunze had been imprisoned late in the war for their activities, and Schwinn had been deported to Argentina. One thing not mentioned in this passage by Haim, although it's implied, the German-American Bund was essentially a front not only for the Nazi Party but for German intelligence, and was very, very active in agitating and spying on behalf of the Third Reich. That the German-American Bund was, in essence, in addition to a political organization, was specifically an espionage front and a political action front for the German Nazi Party. Listeners who would like to go over that in some depth, Haim covers that in considerable detail in his latest book, American Swastika, which is widely available. Returning to this passage now, Ms. Chessis recalled that for years, Flynn had said he wanted to have a John Rogue, spelled phonetically here, R-O-E-G, a member of the Department of Justice, thrown out of high office. I told her that the man she must have been referring to was O. John Rogge, R-O-G-G-E, former assistant to Attorney General Biddle, who had been responsible for the trial of both men. That's Schwinn and Kunz. In the same week of Ms. Chessis' visit, I met the well-known French movie director Barbette Schroeder, who said he could confirm Flynn's Nazism. In 1953, Schroeder was a youth living on the Spanish island of Ibiza when Flynn's black yacht, the Zaca, Z-A-C-A, had been moored below his house. Many times over a period of weeks, Schroeder saw through binoculars a pale, dark-haired man arriving at the yacht at night and leaving before morning, always surreptitiously. Schroeder knew a raffish group of Spanish and German pro-fascists living on the island. He also knew friends of Flynn. He made inquiries. He found out that the man visiting the yacht had been a major Nazi war criminal, leader of a group of exiles called the Spider Organization, and part of a group selling off stolen Nazi art treasures to support themselves in their gun-running activities. Schroeder discovered that Flynn had worked with this man before the war. The point of both of these passages being that Flynn's Nazi activities continued after World War II. He, by the way, was a lover of Evita Peron at one point. And so these connections were not only important and before and during World War II, but extended considerably afterward as well.
Okay, reading some more from Errol Flynn, The Untold Story by Charles Haim.
Before we do, one thing I forgot to mention in connection with the German-American Bund, and it'll be important as you listen to the passage that Nip is talking about here. One of the main people involved in Nazi espionage on the West Coast and in the United States in general was a guy named Captain Fritz Wiedemann, last name W-I-E-D-E-M-A-N-N. Wiedemann was Nazi consul general in San Francisco. As such, he was responsible for coordinating all Nazi West Coast intelligence activities with the Japanese, and at one point headed up the entire Nazi Pacific espionage network. In addition, Wiedemann was also one of the people most responsible for distributing funds to the Nazi organizations in the United States. And incidentally, he also was Adolf Hitler's commanding officer in World War I. In particular, of particular importance here is Wiedemann's role as head of all Nazi espionage in the Pacific, and also his role as one of the primary source of funds to be distributed to not only the German-American Bund, but other Nazi organizations in the country.
Okay, and reading again. In October 1940, Errol attended a party at the home of the Brazilian ambassador. It was full of Nazis. Among them were George or Jörg Gisling, G-Y-S-S-L-I-N-G, Consul General in Los Angeles, and Fritz Wiedemann, Consul General in San Francisco. Federal agents watched Errol very closely at the party. Accompanied by Johnny Meyer, he was seen talking cheerfully with Wiedemann, dancing with two Heil Hitlering Nazi actresses, and a Nazi nightclub singer. He was seen in close discussion with Wiedemann and a member of the Brazilian film industry who was a Nazi sympathizer. The federal agents reported the matter to the studio, but no action was taken. During this period, Errol was almost constantly in the company of Fritz Wiedemann. In vain, a local member of the FBI who wishes to be anonymous pointed out to his superiors that Errol would not consort with Wiedemann after 1939 if he were a loyal British subject. Of course, 1939 was the year that Britain and Germany officially went to war in September, and this is 1940. Errol also began an intense love affair with a Nazi singer named Gertrude Andersen. She was dark-haired, slender, attractive, and very young. She was also on the American government's list of wanted Nazi agents and had connections at the highest level of the Nazi Party in Berlin. But every effort to pin her down on specific charges failed. Errol's affair with Gertrude caused the most drastic consternation in the Warner publicity offices. Every effort was made, successfully, to keep it out of the press. Even when federal agents combed Los Angeles and Beverly Hills, obtaining countless depositions by famous actors and actresses about this woman and Errol's association with her, not a word leaked out.
Note that gathering of those depositions from famous actors and actresses.
Errol extracted, it says, starting the next paragraph, Errol extracted no pleasure from the making of Santa Fe Trail. And then it goes on to some anecdotes. Santa Fe Trail, of course, is interesting because of Errol Flynn's working with such famous actors as Raymond Massey and Ronald Reagan.
Now, remember that Wiedemann, who was one of the most important Nazi intelligence and diplomatic operatives in all of North America, and for all intents and purposes was running Nazi intelligence in the Pacific at this time, also one of the key people in distributing funds to the German-American Bund, that Wiedemann is almost described here as an almost constant companion of Flynn's at this time. And during this time period, Errol Flynn is co-starring in Santa Fe Trail with Ronald Reagan, okay? Now, the Flynn-Wiedemann connection appears to be something which has retained a quality of political dynamite. And we're going to look, again, one of the things that we're asking is possibly, was Ronald Reagan a Nazi spy during World War II? Something about the Flynn spy ring is apparently retained its political clout long after Errol Flynn died. Flynn died in 1959. Haim was working on his book in the late 1970s, and as he began to gather information, a number of people died under ambiguous circumstances. One of those people who died was a former Flynn associate and a procurer for Errol Flynn, someone who used to get women for him, a guy named Johnny Meyer, last name M-E-Y-E-R. Johnny Meyer, interestingly, also worked for Howard Hughes for many years, and that's interesting in light of the Hughes, the massive involvement of the Hughes organization with the U.S. intelligence apparatus, and in turn, the U.S. intelligence hosting of many, many Nazis, including the Eastern Front intelligence system following the war. Of Johnny Meyer's interview with Errol Flynn and Charles Higham, rather, his association with Errol Flynn and his curious death shortly after being interviewed by Higham, Higham writes as follows. Speaking of Flynn, while in San Francisco, he ran into Johnny Meyer, the nightclub owner who had hunted for available girls for him years before. He had Johnny put on his payroll as a pimp, and Johnny stayed with Errol for years until he left to join the personal staff of Howard Hughes. Johnny Meyer's death in 1978 was sudden and shocking. While he was working on his car and on a hillside in Florida close to his home, the car mysteriously backed over him, crushing him to death. During an interview shortly before this, he had admitted to me that he had helped Errol with his Nazi connections in 1938 when, even though Jewish, Meyer, like most Americans, was naive about Nazis and isolationist in politics. He introduced Errol to Fritz Wiedemann, the Nazi consul general in San Francisco and a prominent social figure at a party on Nob Hill. Errol and Wiedemann got to know each other very well during 1939. Johnny Meyer told me, quote, "I believe Errol was not merely in touch with the Nazis in San Francisco, but was actively aiding and abetting them," unquote. So remember that shortly after, this is 1978, almost 20 years after Flynn has been dead, and Johnny Meyer was not the only person to die under strange circumstances, and shortly after admitting to Charles Higham that he had, among other things, introduced Flynn to Fritz Wiedemann, Johnny Meyer was crushed to death when his own car on which he was working rolled downhill over him.
Again, as we talked about in the early part of the show, people involved in these things have a way of dropping off strangely and precipitously. When we did the report on the Kennedy assassination, the Guns of November, one of the things we read from, as we did tonight, was from Penn Jones. And Penn Jones, of course, did a whole list of the amount of people who were bumped off mysteriously, all the witnesses who dropped dead within a couple of years after the Kennedy assassination. As Dave mentioned earlier, Errol Flynn died in 1959, I believe it was. Higham writes, my correspondent in London, Roy Mosley, asked Willy Freeshauer, authority on the subject of espionage and naval history, whether he knew that Flynn was a spy for Germany. Freeshauer replied that he did and added, quote, come and see me tomorrow. This is very dangerous territory. There are people that won't like this found out. Be careful. Tell Mr. Higham to be careful. Next day, Freeshauer was dead, apparently a suicide. One wonders if he caught five bullets in carbon monoxide on his way to his self-inflicted death.
Yeah, or like Daniel Burroughs, who was a three-bullet suicide as well, while in the presence of, well, not in the presence of, but while working with American Nazi Party leader George Lincoln Rockwell. Now, obviously, this information isn't conclusive, but taking the mysterious deaths, particularly Dr. Freeshauer's death, where he specifically warned people, by the way, you're listening to KFJC Los Altos Hills, where Freeshauer specifically warned Higham's correspondent that there are people who would not want the Flynn information to come to light, and that he should be careful and that Higham should be careful. Brutally ironic advice in light of the fact that Freeshauer had less than 24 hours to live. So somebody, there's something about the Errol Flynn connection that is relatively explosive. Somebody was apparently not only monitoring Freeshauer and Higham's activities closely enough, but apparently felt strongly enough about them to silence Freeshauer on relatively short notice. Now, normally we wouldn't pursue the association of Ronald Reagan with the FBI from something as relatively casual as an FBI interview with Reagan concerning a Nazi sympathizer in Hollywood. Recall the agents who were out taking depositions from actors and actresses about Errol Flynn. But we've looked, of course, for many years, at the Reagan presidency and the massive number of Nazis involved with it. I think just running down a few of those might be useful at this point, because it really is the reason why we're asking these questions about Reagan. Of course, all of the Reagan cabinet appointees, or the potential cabinet appointees, the lists were drawn up by a woman named Helena von Damm. She was Reagan's appointment secretary. That is to say, she drew up the lists from which all of his presidential appointments were to be made. Functioned in a similar capacity when Reagan was governor of California. That woman's name, of course, was Helena von Damm. She was the political protege of one of the highest-ranking members of Hitler's SS, a man named Otto von Bolschwing, who was in charge of the Aryanization of all Jewish property that was confiscated from the Jews during the Holocaust. In addition, von Bolschwing, according to reliable reports, then, in addition to working for the Galen organization, became, in fact, the head of the North American Galen operation. J. Peter Grace is heading up the Businessmen's Council on Cutting Costs in Government, or I'm not sure if that's the exact title, but J. Peter Grace is a prominent member of the Knights of Malta, and one of his associates is Otto Ambrose, the man who set up the slave labor camps at Auschwitz and who developed poison gas for the Nazi IG Farben chemical cartel. We've looked at Albert Wiedemeyer, who has been resurrected by Reagan as a special military advisor. Wiedemeyer, in addition to studying in Germany, had a number of different Nazi contacts. He rented his apartment from Gerhard Rossbach, a key stormtroop leader and a member of the Freikorps, later, by the way, a consultant with the CIA. In addition, Wiedemeyer was suspected for a long time, although officially cleared, of having leaked the U.S. plans for coordinated military activity with Britain against Germany. Wiedemeyer was also very close to the chief of the German General Staff, Ludwig Beck, who, although he was a rival of Hitler's and eventually broke with Hitler, Beck was one of the earliest champions of the Nazi Party and its right to exist formally within the ranks of the Reichswehr. We've also taken a look at Lev Dobryansky, Ronald Reagan's ambassador to the Bahamas. Now, Lev Dobryansky was one of the driving forces behind the consolidation of the World Anti-Communist League, which has not only involved Nazi elements, but specifically Lev Dobryansky himself publishes a thing called the Ukrainian Quarterly, which has praised not only many Third Reich elements, but consistently sponsors articles favorable to the OUN Bandera, a group of Ukrainian fascists who worked very closely with the SS and were very much involved in the Third Reich atrocities. Licio Gelli, an Oberleutnant in the SS and very much involved with setting up the Ratline Vatican-sponsored escape network, was an honored guest at Ronald Reagan's inauguration. We've also looked in the past at the Reagan administration efforts to water down the rejection, or basically a court case in which an appeal by a Nazi group called the National Alliance, headed up by an Aryan Nations-associated man named Pierce, basically William Pierce, and he actually, I'm not sure if it's, his last name is Pierce, I'm not sure if it's William Pierce or another one, but anyway, Mr. Pierce heads up the National Alliance, a Nazi group which the Reagan administration was nudging along towards tax-exempt status. They had applied for tax-exempt status as a nonprofit organization. They were denied that. In their subsequent appeal, the Reagan administration weakened the government's case against them. And, of course, we've also looked at the past, in the past, with the Reagans having refused to extradite Edgar Eugene Bradley to New Orleans in connection with Jim Garrison's investigation of the Kennedy assassination. Edgar Eugene Bradley, an associate of, among others, William Potter Gale of the Aryan Nations, the Identity Church of Jesus Christ Christian, the umbrella organization that we spoke about in the past. And also we've looked at Mr. Buchanan, who is sort of Pat Buchanan is Reagan's troubleshooter, I guess you could say, in the White House, and has been vigorously attacking the Office of Special Investigations, which has been attempting to root out some of these Nazi war criminals living in the U.S. and working in the U.S. Since the end of World War II. And Buchanan has been very much involved with, among others, an attempt to exonerate Arthur Rudolph, a V-2 scientist, member of the SA, who is right here in Silicon Valley. All of these Nazi connections that I've been touching on here, just by way of showing why we don't... these are all hard connections between this administration and the Third Reich or domestic Nazis. So this is why it's not such a foolish question, we think, and it's why we're asking the questions, why Mae Russell asked the question many years ago. Was Ronald Reagan part of the Errol Flynn spy ring? How could he have been both an FBI informant and a subversive during the same time period? And a thought to bear in mind, and particularly in connection with the Radio Free America coming up next Wednesday and the following week, remember how Adolf Hitler got his start. Of course, Adolf Hitler was an undercover informant for the German army during the German Revolution at the end of World War I, and specifically functioned as a stool pigeon, where he would infiltrate organizations and inform on them. So in light of Reagan's affinity with Nazis and associations with Nazis as president of the United States, recall his trip to Bitburg, and the fact that he stayed at Bitburg, he stayed at a castle that was managed by a guy who was owned by a guy who was Hitler's godson. And so, again, this is why we ask whether Reagan may have been part of the Flynn spy ring.
Indeed. And what we're going to do right now is we're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back.
Welcome back to the prepared portion of One Step Beyond. I'm going to run through the next few articles very quickly so we have some significant time for phone calls this evening. Very quickly, reading from the New York Times of Sunday, January 29th of 1989, we find the following story: two held in plot to kill Giuliani. That's Rudolph Giuliani, the outgoing federal attorney in Manhattan, the fellow who presided over the Pizza Connection cases. And as we have speculated about, there appear to be some very significant connections between the Pizza Connection heroin operations, in which mafia operations moving heroin through pizza parlors in the East and Midwest were busted by the FBI, and that operation appears to connect up not only with elements of the U.S. national security establishment, but elements of the Reagan administration, and specifically people involved with the Iran-Contra scandal and a number of other scams. Recall that there's a very significant connection between some of the people the Christic Institute called the Secret Team, and we're going to talk about the Christics in just a second, and, among other things, the P2 Lodge-connected Stibom arms for drugs ring involved in the Iran-Contra scandal and also the shooting of the Pope. P2 Lodge, recall, the shadow, the crypto-fascist government that had basically been running Italy for quite some time under Licio Gelli, again, the former Oberleutnant in the SS. Strong connections of P2 both to the United States and Latin America as well. Radio Free America shows 17 through 21, plus numbers 32 and 34, talk about the P2 connections. By the way, we've got a whole bunch of fabulous translations from Dave, our Italian translator, who is cranking out his usual excellent work. We'll have more of those in weeks to come. Of the plot to kill Rudolph Giuliani, again, New York Times, Sunday, January 29th, 1989. Two brothers have been charged with participating in a racketeering conspiracy that prosecutors said included a plot to kill the United States Attorney in Manhattan, Rudolph W. Giuliani, G-I-U-L-I-A-N-I. Federal prosecutors said the two men, Salvatore and Federico Spatola, were involved in a racketeering enterprise which involved conspiracy to commit murder for hire and conspiracy to distribute narcotics, unquote. They said the Spatolas plotted against Mr. Giuliani and others to protect their own illegal drug enterprise. Salvatore Spatola, a convicted drug trafficker, was arrested Friday at the Federal Correctional Institution in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, where he is serving a prison term. Federico Spatola was arrested at the Concadoro Pizzeria in Manhattan and later pleaded not guilty at an arraignment in federal district court. Salvatore Spatola was convicted last year in the attempted murder of a witness in the Pizza Connection drug case, according to the Manhattan District Attorney, Robert M. Morgenthau. And we talked about that attempted murder of the Pizza Connection witness. It happened right as the Iran-Contra scandal was gathering steam. So, again, I wonder if perhaps the recent resignation of Rudolph Giuliani may have been as a result of political pressure. In the program called The December Surprise, The Politics of Terror and the Exoneration of the Secret Team, I speculated at some length about the possibility of a political deal having been cut in which perhaps Rudolph Giuliani would have gone easy on some of the people involved or apparently involved in the Pizza Connection case, say perhaps shying away deliberately from some of the connections leading in the direction of the Pope shooting and the Secret Team et al., whether if perhaps he helped to throw the General Anilon and Film stock manipulation case. General Anilon and Film, the former American subsidiary of IG Farben, represented in this case by Arthur Lyman, the congressional counsel from the Iran-Contra Committee, a man with a lot of interesting connections through his law firm to some of the same elements he supposedly was grilling in the public hearings in 1987. I wonder if perhaps, again, there has been speculation that Giuliani may run for the Republican nomination of mayor. I wonder if perhaps he was subjected to a little carrot and stick. Say, basically, if you serve us well in the Pizza Connection case, serve us well in the General Anilon and Film case, if you also serve us well by dismissing charges against a number of people charged with smuggling arms to Iran who claimed that they were working as part of the Iran-Contra operation, and specifically that they were working for, among others, George Bush, that also, that case was thrown out of court. And I wonder if perhaps Giuliani was offered rewards for cooperating, and perhaps threats were placed to see to it that he understood there could be some negative consequences of not going along. Again, that's speculation. But as we looked at in the December surprise program, there was a lot of movement in December and early January with regard to the Iran-Contra scandal. That movement is still going on, as we'll see. I wonder if this plot to kill Giuliani had anything to do with his resignation coming at this time and coming right after these key cases, right after the Pizza Connection 4 case with all of its potential explosive angles, right after the General Anilon and Film case with its connections to people involved in Iran-Contra, and also the dismissal of charges against 11 people for running arms to Iran. Again, food for thought and grounds for further research. The Christic Institute, the public interest law firm, which has popularized the term Christic, the term secret team, previously used by Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty in his book by that name, The Secret Team, to describe the U.S. intelligence system and its many allies. Well, the Christic Institute continues to fall on hard times in a court of law. Reading now from the San Jose Mercury News from Saturday, February 4th of 1989, an AP story datelined Miami, headlined Targets of Contra Conspiracy Suit Awarded $1 Million. A federal judge on Friday criticized a Guns for Drugs conspiracy lawsuit against Contra and ex-CIA figures, calling it an abuse of the legal system and awarding the defendants $1 million in fees and costs. Chief U.S. District Judge James Lawrence King last June threw out the $24 million lawsuit filed by the Christic Institute on behalf of journalists Tony Avergan and Martha Honey. On Friday, King issued a follow-up ruling requiring the plaintiffs to pay the defendants $955,000 in attorney fees plus $79,500 in court costs. Some of the 29 defendants, who include Contra leader Adolfo Calero, ex-CIA Deputy Chief of Operations Theodore Shackley, Iran-Contra figures Albert Hakim and Richard Secord, conservative activist former Major General John Singlaub and others, promised action against the liberal Washington-based Christic Institute. This is the signal to begin the counterattack, Singlob said of King's action. I think this will put a damper on this kind of courthouse terrorism against those who are fighting against the radical left, unquote. Skipping down the Christic Institute's response to this action, the Christic Institute bitterly criticized the ruling by King, noting that its appeal of his decision last June was still before the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta. They are also appealing Friday's ruling, seeking an immediate stay. Quote, Judge King's decision was a legal disgrace, said Christic attorney Daniel Sheehan, who assembled much of the case. His ruling will only strengthen our position in the appeals court that Judge King is committing a consistent pattern of legal error. Again, noting the arrest and recent health problems of John Hull, one of the main figures in the Christic Institute's lawsuit, given the deaths of key people that they were seeking either as witnesses to provide as informants of one kind or another, one wonders if perhaps some of that direct interference has something to do with the lawsuit being thrown out. Recall also that Richard Secord was actually securing $100,000 to work against the Christic Institute. Money was being diverted specifically to foil the Christic Institute's efforts. Within the program that's available in the archives called The December Surprise, I speculated considerable length, and I air my working hypothesis that, in fact, the apparent demise of many of the charges against Oliver North, the decision to dismiss some of the key charges against Oliver North, stemmed from the interrelationship between two plane crashes that took place in December. One was the plane crash that killed former Israeli security expert and Oliver North associate Aviram Nir, one of the key players in the Iran-Contra scandal, and the other was the crash of Pan Am Flight 103 in Lockerbie, Scotland, on December 21st of 88, at the hands of terrorists unknown. And again, it is my working hypothesis in that broadcast that the circumstances surrounding those two crashes not only eliminated key witnesses and served to intimidate other people who might have provided key information, but they froze, in a sense, the documents pertaining to terrorism in 1985 and 86, some of which were being sought by Lawrence Walsh, the special prosecutor. The hypothesis that I am airing is that it was not Palestinian terrorists so much as it was elements of the U.S. national security establishment, specifically elements working on behalf of or allied with the secret team, quote-unquote, that precipitated not only the downing of Aviram Nir's plane, but also the Lockerbie crash as well, in order to eliminate witnesses, eliminate evidence, and intimidate others. An article which I went over in the phone-in session of an earlier broadcast sheds some ominous light on that working hypothesis that I presented in the program, again, the December Surprise, the Politics of Terror, and the Exoneration of the Secret Team. I can't go into the whole broadcast in the context here, but it was a very, very long program, a two-parter, some 4 or 5 hours, real time. So I'm not going to attempt to describe it more than I have. This particular article is very important, though, when taken in light of the December Surprise. This was sent in by a listener from the Arizona Republic of Tuesday, January 3rd of 1988. This is a Republic Wire Services story headlined, Unchecked Cargo Put on Doomed Jet. Subheaded, West German officials admit lacks security. West German authorities disclosed Monday that some freight was loaded onto doomed Pan Am Flight 103 without being checked, and searchers in Scotland recovered part of the tail section of the Boeing 747. Meanwhile, a Canadian team that helped investigate the 1985 bombing of an Air India jetliner joined the probe into the disaster. A spokesman for the West German Federal Prosecutor's Office in Frankfurt, where Flight 103 originated with a smaller plane December 21st, said Monday that investigators have found that freight, including 4 bags of U.S. military mail, was loaded onto the plane without security checks. The spokesman, Hubert Harth, H-A-R-T-H, said that the freight was put on a Pan Am 727 that flew the first leg of Flight 103 from Frankfurt. In London, the cargo was transferred to the ill-fated Boeing 747, on which Flight 103 continued, again without a security check. He added, however, that the mailbags were, quote, constantly guarded by U.S. military personnel, unquote. The West German weekly Bunte said Monday that a document box from manufacturer's Hanover Trust also was loaded in Frankfurt and transferred in London without being checked.